Smestions.
My stomach just made a noise like the opening bass sound in State of Independence by Donna Summer. Just like that.
Exactly. I'm glad it was you, because I heard it and I thought, heavens, what?
It's the central line.
No, I thought it was me. I was just delighted that it wasn't me. It was your central line.
Yeah, and wouldn't it be great if we could play Donna Summer now just to reproduce that sound? But sadly, it would then cost like £6 million, which we'd have to play to the producer, I think was Michael O'Martin, I think. But anyway, don't matter.
What, Michael?
Yeah, the bass player was Louis Johnson. But who was the producer? Is it Michael O'Martin? They're coming back to us on that.
I could just Google it.
I think that's what they're doing.
I know, but I could probably do it faster. State of Independence.
Yeah, Wikipedia.
Independence producer.
Oh, Quincy Jones.
Quincy Jones.
Apparently, yeah. A very entertaining discourse, don't you think?
Yeah, this is absolutely worth the subscription.
Question number one. Yes. Who produced the record that Simon Stomach did an opening bass line from? Alex in Bristol. Again, this is Alex just writing about stuff and tagging on a question. I've enjoyed your recent chats about music that make you cry.
Good.
I listened to the previously unknown to me Tank Park Salute and found it almost unlistenably sad. It got me, which is the point.
Yes.
It got me wondering about the film equivalents of this topic. I don't mean the films or film scenes that make you cry, which are supposed to make you cry, because Tank Park Salute is obviously intended to be sad. I mean the films and scenes which aren't particularly supposed to be sad, but nevertheless leave you blubbing, but you don't know why.
Yes.
I've been thinking about this idea since I saw Spider-Man No Way Home at the cinema. I don't have any particular affinity with the Spider-Man films. I quite like the ones I've seen, but that's about it. I only went to see it as I was babysitting a six-year-old. Okay. But the scene where Andrew Garfield appears...
Left the six-year-old at home and went to the cinema.
Well, did you take the six-year-old to... Anyway, the scene where Andrew Garfield appears, which was a spoiler, made me inexplicably emotional. I was fighting back tears in the cinema and I couldn't even think about it without welling up for some days afterwards. Ever since, I've been trying to work out what it was about this scene that touched such a nerve for me. I wonder if there are any films or particular scenes which make you or any listeners much more emotional than they can rationally explain. And that is interesting. So obviously we're aware of sadness in films and lacrimosity and so on. But has there ever been a scene or a movie which is not intended to make you sad, but you just go, oh, blimey, Charlie?
Well, it depends on whether you're defining sadness as something which makes you cry, because I cry a lot in films, in things that aren't sad.
I guess, have you ever been moved and you can't work out why? That's the key. Why am I responding to this film the way I am?
I mean, here's the weird thing. Because my job is to respond to films and then ask why. I know I don't mean that to sound pretentious, but I'm probably not very good at it. But that is my job, is to watch films and then respond to them and then explain why I've responded to them in a way. So I cannot remember, I'm sure there must have been, but I cannot remember an instance in which, because what usually happens if I'm watching a film and I start feeling something, I immediately sort of interrogate why I do, because it's a way of then explaining the film. You know, if you just go see a film and go, I like it, makes me laugh, makes me cry, that's all right. But it's, if you say, I like it, it makes me laugh because this, this, and this, and it made me cry because that, that, and that, that's context. I can't think of a circumstance, certainly since I've been doing this professionally, which is, you know, from a previous century, in which I haven't been able to figure out, or I haven't known why. I'm sure there must be. I mean, there are films that have an unexpectedly profound effect. I would go back to Jeremy, because it's ridiculous how much that film upset me, and I love it for it. But I suppose I was in the right place and time for it. But you can think of anything?
I couldn't. But I am intrigued. Because, I mean, it's very rare in music. I mean, I've only got that one example of Finlandia, which has been discussed and has been explained, maybe. But if there are, we'll find out. If there are scenes that make you cry where you cannot work out why you are feeling like that, let us know, correspondence@kermanandmayo.com.
Yeah.
Connor in Wexford. Given the amount of father-son, mother-daughter stories, not to mention the mountain of TV shows and films that deal with father-daughter relationships, I was wondering if either of you knew why there are comparatively so few mother-son stories. When films and television do have mother-son stories, it's often either played for comedy, with the son being a pathetic mama's boy, or has Oedipal undertones. Is this a result of most writers being male? A lack of acting roles being offered to older female actors, or something else entirely? I only thought, plus looked up, mother-son stories.
Right.
Forrest Gump came up.
Yeah. Sally Field.
Shadowlands. Well, that kind of works. Throw Mama from the train probably is not very helpful. Goats, people like us. And AI actually came up.
Yeah, AI is, that is a brilliant example of, I mean, AI is so heartbreaking. And the opening movement of it with Monica and, you know, that is just breathtaking. And then, of course, the perfect day at the end. I mean, that is definitely a film about mother-son relationships. In fact, I would argue that it's one of the best films about mother-son, because it's not the other thing. It's not played for laughs. It's not Oedipal. It's and of course the irony of it is, he's not her son, but that's what he wants to be. It's Pinocchio. He wants to be a real boy. Pinocchio wants to be Geppetto's real son.
Now I'm annoyed all over again that we didn't get to do Spielberg for The Fablemans because he was ill and had to go home. Because
yes,
it would have been great to revisit just at the end, if time allowed, and there wasn't someone giving me a wind-up message just to say, AI, time to, you know, you made this film a long time ago. Time to go back.
Kind of fascinating. I mean, AI gets better every year, and it seems more prescient every year. But it is so moving. That whole central relationship between David and Monica in the film is so moving.
Owen Lacey, I've been an avid listener of your show for quite some time, medium-term listener, I think they call me. As I type this email, the Writers Guild of America finds itself in the midst of a strike, raising concerns about the impact of streaming on the industry. And we were talking about this with Greta Gerwig. It seems that the surge in streaming services has become closely intertwined with issues surrounding fair compensation. Notably, the Guild suggests that the rise of streaming platforms has played a significant role in the current predicament. Actor Sean Gunn recently highlighted this disparity in an interview, where he drew attention to the remuneration gap between CEOs like Bob Iger, yes, and the lowest paid workers. He emphasized that in the 1980s, CEOs earned around 30 times more than the lowest paid employers. Today, individuals like Bob Iger earn a staggering 400 times the salary of their lowest paid counterparts. Gunn's comments underscore the concerns many industry professionals have regarding the fairness of pay distribution. So, as ever with these questions, schmestions,
yes,
little sermon and then a little question tagged, sure, on at the end. In light of these developments, the question arises, can we address the growing concern that streaming services are negatively impacting the industry?
As far as I understand it, as far as actors are concerned, I mean, this is largely because Brian Cox was talking about it, the big issue is to do with residuals. And So residuals are, if you take part in something and then it is repeated, or it is every time it goes into a different platform, you get payment for it. And we were talking before about Billy Bragg. I remember Billy Bragg telling me that when he was, Go Discs, wasn't it, originally he was with, and he had a big discussion with them about him retaining his copyright. And it was, why was it? And he said, because this is my pension. And he was like, you know, he was a young man at that point. He said, this is my pension. He said, I'm a songwriter. That's what I do. This is my trade. And if I carry on being a songwriter and working all my life as a songwriter, when I stop, my songs will provide me with a pension. That's my pension. Residuals for actors are a way of providing for yourself in the future. And one of the issues that's been raised is that residuals are no longer anything like they should be. I know somebody whose uncle, was one of the players in a major studio orchestra, and each player in that orchestra would receive residuals every year for a film that they had taken part in. And the whole way that residual structures have changed, have really changed over the years. I still get residuals for some stuff that I did ages and ages ago, but it's nowadays I would never expect to see any residuals of any of the stuff I do. As far as streaming services is concerned, well, there's 2 points. Firstly, the thing about the disparity between what the heads of studios earn and what the lowest paid earn. Of course, the lowest paid now are VFX workers who are, you know, scattered to the four winds and non-unionized because it's a profession in which it's possible to just ship it out. We were talking just recently about it's amazing. You make a great big, you know, multi-million, $100 million movie, and yet you're snippy about paying the VFX artists. So Neil Brand was talking about this recently, and there's become this kind of policy about what you do is whenever you cite anyone, you should say what they earn. So, you know, the so-and-so head of thing who earned $30 million last year said, we don't have enough money to pay blah, 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 blah. What's happened with streaming services is that it's accelerated a process which was kind of in process anyway. And in that documentary recently, Brainwash, which was about the misogyny and the male gaze and the work environment in Hollywood, it was saying that, you know, Hollywood as a work environment has been absolutely terrible, certainly in terms of equal pay. Anything to do with equal pay has been kind of fairly recently that struggle has been fought. I think the problem is streaming services are here to stay. There's no point in being annoyed at them. What you have to do is to change them. Being annoyed at streaming is like being annoyed at Wednesday. It's coming round whatever you do. And there must be ways of restructuring pay to create more equilibrium in Hollywood. But as we know, through so many industries, we now live in a world in which the very rich are fantastically rich. And the, you know, the other end of it are fantastically not.
It just feels like part of the conversation which we had with Greta Gerwig on Take One, which is just part, which we were talking about the strike. And I just go back to that sense of her thinking, I don't know, I don't know what the way, obviously there is a basic principle of paying people what they're supposed to have, but we're at the very beginning of this conversation. Mm-hmm. And how do you, like, for example, on beginning of Take One started with an AI version of me and an AI version of you.
Yeah.
Now, in theory, that's, if that went out somewhere else, that would be a breach of copyright, wouldn't it? Because that's you, that's me.
Yeah, I don't know. I mean, I was, you know, there's that thing where you have radio adverts and somebody does a voice alike of somebody. Now, somebody listening who is a lawyer will correct me on this. I think that the law is, if as long as you're not trying to pass it off, you can get away with it.
Yeah.
But it's, I think that's correct. And yet that's a very, very gray area.
Yes.
You know, you hear a voice, it sounds familiar. And it's like, you know, so if somebody did that, they took your voice, that AI voice, and they used it to advertise GB News or some other equally toxic scumbag thing. And then they said, but yeah, but that's not Simon Mayo. It's just a voice that happens to sound a bit like Simon Mayo. I have no idea. You'd have to prove that they were passing off voice as you.
I think I had this conversation a long time ago now, so the law may have changed, with an actor called Stephen Nallan, who was the voice behind the spitting image Margaret Thatcher, which was the best. So he could do Margaret Thatcher as long as it was clear that he wasn't Margaret Thatcher.
Right.
So he could do a voiceover doing his Margaret Thatcher voice, as long as it was
an evident that it wasn't
version. But if he tried to actually be Margaret, then that was actionable. But the point is about copyright, I think, about what do you own?
Yes, but this is why, again, we come back to residuals, which is if you perform in a film and the film then has a life, you know, beyond it, should you be remunerated for it? If you remember, when Back to the Future 2 came out, there was an issue. In fact, you and I wrote about this in the Movie Doctors. There was an issue with Crispin Glover, who was in the first film. He's not in the second film, but the character that he plays is in the second film. And there was there were attempts to pass off somebody else as him. And he fought a battle about who owned his image rights. And nowadays you hear stories about people actually having it written into their will that their image cannot be digitally used for, you know, X number of years. We're in uncharted territory.
We absolutely are.
But the only thing I would say is, it's happening. What you can't do is go streaming bad, AI bad. What you have to do is go, how can we make it better?
Steve Roberts, formerly of Sundridge Park in Kent, now residing in the magnificently double-hyphenated Ho Ho Cuss in New Jersey. That's H-O-H-O-.
That's a real place. Ho-Ho-Cus.
Yes.
Wow.
K-U-S. Huh. Yes, here we go.
America's got some brilliant place names, isn't it? Like Poughkeepsie and Hoboken and, you know.
First-time emailer, enthusiastic but ultimately unsuccessful contestant on the breakfast show's Identikit quiz on Radio 1, which was... Which was me.
Yeah. No, it was Simon Bates.
Very good. I'm writing with a reference to the last question, Schmestion, and your correspondence question about who one might cast as Donald Trump in any forthcoming biopic. My suggestion, no one. I think it would be wonderful to take a cue from Kitty Green's 2019 movie, The Assistant, and have the villainous main character shown almost entirely off screen. For me, this serves two purposes. One, it's entirely appropriate to switch the focus away from such a non-character and instead concentrate on the real people impacted by his actions. For instance, showing the White House cleaning staff wiping ketchup-stained burger remnants from a meeting room wall and not the wingnut tantrum-throwing numpty flinging his lunch. And two, it would amuse me no end to think of Trump watching the movie, perhaps behind bars, and becoming increasingly bewildered and then infuriated as to why he wasn't even in his own story.
That's very good.
Like he wasn't even the best Donald in it.
Yeah,
in fact,
good.
If you could cast Donald Sutherland in it, he could then be not the best Donald in it. Anyway, hello to Jason, narrated Sanji. It's an interesting point.
Actually. It is a good idea.
That's the way to do it.
It's a good idea because it would prick his vanity, the idea that he wasn't even in it. Would make him really, really cross.
Just notice that there actually isn't a question there. Very good.
Okay, but it's,
it's a correspondence based on a previous question.
Yeah.
Luke Farmer in Northampton. There have been a number of times I've considered emailing you, but never got round to it. However, on hearing the recent email from a listener regarding animal byproducts used in film production.
Oh, yes.
Here is the niche subject that I thought I would weigh in on.
Thank you.
Okay. As an active member of the analog photography community and also a vegetarian, this subject is something that has been widely discussed.
Oh, wow. Okay, fine.
Yes, indeed. Gelatin is used in the production of motion picture and photographic film. Gelatin is created using cattle bone rendered from the beef production process. Film contains a layer of gelatin that is used to hold the silver halide crystals present in film. Simply put, these crystals react with light and create the image on the film. Over the years, companies such as Kodak attempted to create alternatives to using gelatin, but were mostly unsuccessful. Save for a very few types of Polaroid film, all film still uses a small amount of gelatin. Kodak created a process that uses a non-animal-based polymer mixture to reduce the amount of gelatin used. However, unless the world eradicates the entire meat industry, producing gelatin from bone waste material is actually an environmentally preferable way to dispose of unwanted bone, as otherwise it is typically sent for disposal in landfill. As 5 minutes of research online will tell you, the amount of gelatin used in film production is tiny compared to the number of animals that are slaughtered for their meat. Between 3 to 9 grams of gelatin is used per square meter of film. So the bones of one single animal can produce tens of thousands of rolls of film. Quite frankly, the assertion that as a vegetarian you should not be reviewing films that are shot on film is utterly ludicrous.
Thank you.
An alternative from your listener that was all films should be produced on digital mediums. Well, without getting too much into this, we're about to get into this. If we look at the minerals used to create the electronics in modern digital cameras, we would find cassiterite, columbite, tantalite, and wolframite, among many others. I must include
Meshach Abednego.
Correct. These are all usually mined from areas of the world which at best have sketchy human rights records. These conflict minerals are also used to create everyday objects, including light bulbs, cars, medical equipment, and so on.
Well,
then concludes, just a thought to leave you with. By listening to this program for 1 hour via a streaming platform, you are producing 55 grams of CO2 equivalent. Not a lot, but also not nothing. A phrase you could also use to perhaps describe the amount of gelatin used in film production. So at the risk of going on and on, I'm really looking forward to watching Oppenheimer and also hearing your review.
Very good. I think that covers the subject very thoroughly.
I think it does, doesn't it? Because, yes.
I mean, we were talking before about, vegetarians saying if people are going to kill animals to eat them, better that they eat the whole animal when we were talking about the discussion before,
So, I don't think there's anyone who's going to seriously think you should, as a vegetarian, you should stop watching films.
Oh, I'm not doing that.
No, I don't think so either. No. And clearly, digital also has its issues as well.
Yeah, it's an imperfect world.
And we'll just do one more from David.
Colonial Common, a long-term listener, frequent emergency mailer, been reading Brian Cox's exceptional autobiography, Putting the Rabbit in the Hat.
I enjoy very much.
Which is possibly a better use of the term about putting something in the hat as opposed to the one Mark suggested whilst watching Mission Impossible. Is what Mark put in the hat? No. Anyway, in it, I was surprised to read he had a there but for the grace of God moment when he was due to take a flight that ultimately crashed. My question is, have either of you had one of those moments where it worked in your favour when you've missed a flight or train? Not necessarily that you may have come to an end, but you may have missed something that was amazing if you'd gone with an original plan. Anyway, thanks for all the amazing work you do, is how David signs off. And I've been racking my brains to think of something where fortune has stepped in and I have either made something or not made something. And I came up with a blank piece of paper.
Oh, I thought you were going to say I came up with an absolute banger of a...
No, unfortunately not.
Yeah, I mean, I've certainly never had anything that was that was dramatic enough to be memorable. I mean, I have missed flights, but I haven't then thought, that's great because now I got to meet somebody in an airport. You know, I went to the wrong place and I ended up... You know, so no, I think I can't think of something that's happened. I know a story about a friend of mine. This isn't going to get a friend of mine who missed a train, ended up having to stay somewhere. As a result of it, met his wife, his future wife. Didn't just meet his wife. He met the person who then became his wife. But you'd have to have them tell you the story because it takes quite a long time.
So very quickly, we'll finish on this one actually from Claire Linney. Whilst doing some research on time travel for a book I'm writing, I came across the grandfather paradox.
Okay.
Often used in films to describe the risk of travelling back in time, accidentally killing your parent and therefore erasing your existence. This means that you can't kill your parent, you survive to go back and kill the parent and so on, creating the paradox and potentially inadvertently ending the known universe.
Yeah.
My shmestion is then, shouldn't this be called the grandmother paradox, given that nobody can be 100% sure of the paternity of their father or grandfather? And as such, apparently 3% of the general population may have misattributed parentage. Then to ensure a paradox, you'd have to kill your grandmother or mother to be certain. There, you hadn't thought of that, had you?
That's very good. And it reminds me to bring this to a close of the line from Oppenheimer, which is in the trailer, when Matt Damon says, so hang on, you're saying there's a possibility that when we flick this switch, we might obliterate the entire world. And Cillian Murphy's character says, you know, chances are close to zero. He says, close to zero? And he said, well, what do you want? He said, zero.
Yes.
Zero would be nice.
So Claire Linney, the answer to your question is yes. We agree with you. There you go. Easily dealt with. Send your question or shmestion to correspondence@curbitandmayo.com.